Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. We live in an age of extraordinary technological addiction. We find ourselves spending more time in front of screens than in front of faces. Children and teens in particular find it difficult to manage their time productively when entranced by the addictive siren of the screen. Something is happening to our brains when we stare at a television or laptop screen for many hours, or interact with a smartphone and laptop for most of the day, or prefer to connect, chat, or simply play with others through a screen rather than in person. The addiction to the screen is real, and for children and teens, it can have real adverse consequences that can be debilitating. Fortunately, there are solutions. My guest today is Dr. Richard Cytoic. He's the author of Your Stone Age Brain in the Screen Age, Coping with Digital Distraction and Sensory Overload. Dr. Cytoic is professor of neurology at George Washington University. He's the author of the books Synesthesia, The Man Who Tasted Shapes, and also Wednesday is Indigo Blue, Discovering the Brain of Synesthesia. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange, Professor.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with your background. Who are you? What do you do?
I am a professor of neurology and neuropsychology at George Washington University. I've always been interested in higher cortical functions of the brain, that is, instead of reflexes and multiple sclerosis and peripheral neuropathy and things like that, I've always been interested in the mind, how we think and the ways in which we think.
Well, before you wrote this book, you wrote two books on synesthesia. What is synesthesia?
Oh, synesthesia. Everybody knows the word anesthesia, meaning no sensation. Synesthesia means joined or coupled sensation. And there are children born with two, three, or all five of their senses hooked together so that my voice, for example, is not just something that they hear, but something that they also see, touch, feel, or taste. And they are really surprised that their playmates are not like them. And they think, oh my God, I'm the only one like this in the world. And so there's a great sense of alienation. But it turns out, actually, that synesthesia is quite common as a perceptual trait. 4% of the population carry the genes for this perceptual trait.
Well, you know, it's interesting because one of my daughters, Maddie, she sees colors with numbers. When she sees a number, she sees a color.
She's a grapheme synesthete. So letters and numbers are colored, even though they're printed in black ink. Yes.
Yes.
So, and so does anybody else in the family have this?
No, it's extraordinary, but she's an artist, so I'm assuming that.
No, so normally synesthesia runs strongly in families from either parent to either child down through three, four, or five generations. So if your daughter doesn't have anybody in her immediate family who's synesthetic, then she is a spontaneous mutation. And so then the really interesting question is, why did evolution keep this trait so prominent? You know, it's pretty, you know, but otherwise useless. And if it's useless, then evolution should have jettisoned it long ago. And the answer is then, well, it must not be useless. And so if you ask synesthetes, what good is it for? They'll say, well, it helps remember things. And in turn, it turns out that they have extraordinary memories when you test them on conventional memory tests. And it helps them remember phone numbers and street addresses, and there's a file of facts in their mind, really.
Well, it's interesting because that tracks with my daughter. Let's get back to you. You wrote the book.
Okay, me.
You wrote the book, Your Stone Age Brain in the Screen Age.
Yes.
Seemingly as a word of caution or a warning. And one of the endorsements of your book reads, quote, "This book is an urgent must-read for parents like myself who are worried about their screen-addicted kids, but also a warning to us all of the Trojan horse of consumer technology as it rapidly degrades our tragically ill-adapted brains," end quote.
Right, that's Marcos Lutyens. Yes, well, he's quite right that our attention spans have gone to hell. Everybody knows that. People want to stop looking at their screens, their phones, their iPads, their laptops, and they can't do it. And I think the difficulty is that people look at this as a challenge between you versus it, a device, an object, a screen. But the real battle is between you and yourself.
Mm.
You know, I think most listeners will be surprised that the brain has a fixed energy limit. And no amount of diet, exercise, Sudoku puzzles, or supplements can change it. And so if we are up against this fixed energy limit, then we have to learn to live with it. The brain is an energy hog. It consumes 20% of the daily calories that we ingest while making up only 2% of our body's mass. And it's strange that, you know, people obsess over what foods they put in their body, non-GMO.
Organic.
Gluten-free. No artificial coloring, etc. But nobody ever thinks to say, what am I ingesting through my senses? And what we are ingesting through our senses is a lot of mental garbage.
Well, you write about the brain energy cost of screen distractions.
Yes.
And the cost sounds like a price that we pay, is it?
Oh, it is. Yeah, because as I said, we have a fixed amount of energy that we have available. And so one of the most expensive things that we can do, and I'm thinking in terms of engineering and what does a certain mental function cost? And one of the most expensive things we can do is to switch attention from A to B, from one thing to another. And this is what screens demand of us all the time. We're constantly swiping up and scrolling, and our attention is going from one thing to another, and it's just sapping us of our energy.
My guest is Dr. Richard Cytoic, professor of neurology at George Washington University and author of Your Stone Age Brain in the Screen Age, Coping with Digital Distraction and Sensory Overload. Professor, if you don't mind, I'd like you to read an excerpt from your preface, starting with the paragraph where you write, "We live in a paradox."
I'd be happy to. "We live in a paradox in which digital tech alleviates some social isolation, even as it worsens it in some other ways. We are technologically more connected than ever before, yet bond on platforms engineered to make outrage and indignation infectious. They exploit the psychological principle that emotion, like yawning, is highly contagious. Raw emotion allows for neither nuance nor complexity, but it easily overwhelms critical thinking and leaves us swayed by propaganda and manipulation that is hard to recognize for what it is." Two fashionable phrases in education circles are critical thinking and connecting the dots. But surfing the internet encourages shallow gulps of the data stream, not critical thinking, while offloading factoids to external apps like Google leaves users with little common knowledge and thus few dots to connect. A mind capable of ascertaining connection thrives on quiet, not on endless texts and notifications. There is a reason the natural world is easy in the eyes and ears, yet we cut ourselves off from its restorative power, forgetting that the brain, the psyche, and the soul need rest and uninterrupted interludes rather than streaks, autoplay, and push notifications that turn friendships and achievements into ruthless competition. The Latin word addictum once described the length of time an indentured slave or addict had to serve their master. The word's root means bound to. And are we not bound like slaves to the screens in front of us? If not, then why do so many people claim to be addicted?
Oh, my word. And that preface leads right into your first chapter, which is frightening. You write about an engineered addiction that in children can produce virtual autism. Your quote, virtual autism. Please explain.
Yes.
Tell us what virtual autism is.
Well, virtual autism means that autistic-like symptoms induced by heavy screen exposure. And this was shown a number of years ago by a Romanian psychiatrist that were dealing with orphans there. And so the heavier the screen exposure, the more autistic-like symptoms individuals exhibit. And we've all seen this. You've seen a kid on his gaming console, and you say, Johnny, and he won't look at you. You get a grunt if you're lucky, no eye contact, etc. So, if you try to take the device away from them, you get a humongous meltdown and temper tantrum, as if you're taking cocaine away from an addict. So the symptoms are reduced eye contact. First of all, they don't look you in the eye. They don't look anybody in the eye. Reduced socialization. They are totally isolated within themselves and not interacting with other people around them. And reduced language. So all you get is a grunt. You don't get a complete sentence out of them. And so this is virtual autism. And I think every parent who's dealt with a kid who's addicted to their iPad knows this. They have seen this time and time again. And here's the thing, that if you take these devices away for just a week, 5 to 7 days, the symptoms start to revert. And that never happens in developmental autism.
So you made a juxtaposition between virtual autism and developmental autism.
Right. Well, yes, developmental autism is common. It's got a genetic basis, etc., and it appears at an early age. It's marked by a tremendous deficit in socialization, but it never reverses, whereas virtual autism will reverse once you take the screens away.
So there's a solution.
Yes, indeed.
Our insistence, or convenience rather, of having our young kids on these screens for so long is debilitating.
It is. You know, I call the iPad the worst babysitter of all time. And parents say it's the only thing that keeps them quiet. But when you plonk your newborn or toddler in front of an eye screen, you are blocking their developing central vision and you are robbing them of something really important. And that's why I call iPads, doing that with an iPad, a form of child abuse. It really is. But parents don't know that. They think they're doing the best things. And in fact, they're doing the worst possible thing.
Wow. Okay, well, we're going to have to take a brief break. We'll return in a moment with my guest, Dr. Richard Cytowic, professor of neurology at George Washington University and author of Your Stone Age Brain in the Screen Age, Coping with Digital Distraction and Sensory Overload. I'm Mike Green. You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange on JPR. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is Dr. Richard Cytowic, professor of neurology at George Washington University and author of Your Stone Age Brain in the Screen Age, Coping with Digital Distraction and Sensory Overload. Professor, you write, quote, "An enduring myth says we use only 10% of our brain. The other 90% presumably stands idly by to serve as spare capacity," end quote. Why do you call this a myth? And if so, why has it endured?
Well, it's endured only because it's been repeated so often. The brain is an energy hog. It consumes 20% of the calories we eat every day, while accounting for only 2% of its weight. In infants and toddlers, it's even more. In infants, it's 60%. So yeah, it's an energy hog. And we have to appreciate that it has fixed limits that it can deal with. It wants all this energy, and yet there's not enough to give it. We don't have an extra oomph that we can step on the gas pedal and give it more. As I said, no amount of diet, exercise, Sudoku, puzzles, or supplements can increase the amount of energy that it has to work with, so that we have to learn to work within its prescribed limits.
Professor, you write about how screen distractions begin in the most peripheral part of our visual field, and you tell the story of your grandnephew, Max.
Ah, my grandnephew, I was holding him one day and the TV came on. My nephew was turning on the weather, and Max's eyes and head just zeroed in on that. So that's called the orienting reflex. So anything novel is going to grab your stimulus. But in terms of the peripheral location of distractions, Google Glass is the perfect example of this. Google Glass had its notifications in your upper temporal field, and that is exactly the visual field that feeds into the limbic system. And so you get something there and you're going to get a, oh my God, yes. We've seen that, you know, something catches us in the corner of our eye. This is the corner of our eye field. And Google Glass was brilliant technology, but horrible psychology, because it was always stimulating that part of our visual field. Screens almost always do the same thing, because they're stimulating us everywhere, but they're also stimulating that part of the visual field.
Professor, speaking of stimulation, you wrote, quote, "Ample evidence explains why introducing tech impedes the natural development of a child who would otherwise have normal amounts of person-to-person interaction. It is true that growing up isolated and deprived of human contact drastically stunts brain development, but it does not logically follow that using tech to supplement a child's typical environment will boost cognitive development. Too much stimulation is equally detrimental as not having enough," end quote. You're saying it does not logically follow that using tech to supplement a child's typical environment will boost cognitive development, because too much stimulation is equally detrimental as not having enough. And when these kids are sitting in front of the screen all the time.
Because kids, humans, have developed to speak to and socialize with one another. And so you have a baby and a toddler and their parents and grandparents, and they play so big, peekaboo, and later on a shoe store, a restaurant, and all sorts of imaginative games. They are socializing with one another. And that's the important thing, socializing, speaking to another person face to face, hearing the sounds of their speech rhythms, etc. And when you supplant that with some digital device, you're not getting that at all. And so what digital devices do is they really rob a developing brain of that kind of socialization.
Well, Professor, our interaction with screens produces real emotions, whether we're texting, reading, or watching the content others have produced, or responding to them, or just playing games. Is the emotional engagement part of the addiction to screens?
Well, there is an emotional addiction, but the question is, it's an emotional reaction with whom? It's not an emotional reaction to anybody, any person. It's with this disembodied entity. So I think that it's totally different qualitatively.
My guest is Dr. Richard Cytoic, professor of neurology at George Washington University and author of Your Stone Age Brain in the Screen Age, Coping with Digital Distraction and Sensory Overload. Professor, how does dopamine work in the brain?
Well, dopamine is often thought of as the desire molecule, but it's actually not. It's the reward molecule. So when we anticipate a reward, we get a dopamine surge, and that makes us more inclined to go for whatever's going to reward us.
Well, you write about missing critical time windows, which can degrade our empathy. What do you mean?
Well, there are critical windows for developing language, for example, for developing emotion, for example. And so if a young child isn't exposed to human language, it doesn't matter what the language is, but if they're not exposed to their parents' language at an early age, then they will never learn to develop that language. And so that's what's meant by critical. So there's, and after that, they can't do it. And this is why, for example, if you want to have bilingual children, in order for children to learn a second or third language, they need to learn it before the age of 6. Because after that, the critical window for learning language closes. And that's why it's so hard for all of us in high school struggle to learn French and German and Latin. They should have taught us way earlier.
Well, you also write about social learning in kindergarten, and you offer the example of Waldorf students. Tell me more.
Yes. Well, the Waldorf schools are fantastic, and the Waldorf schools go back to Germany in the early 19th century, where Emil Molt, the owner of the Waldorf Astoria cigarette factory, wanted to set up an educational thing for his employees' children. And in Germany, you know, it's in the constitution that you have to develop young people to be fully independent citizens. Anyway, fast forward. Now in the United States here, we have Waldorf-associated schools. They don't have any technology until, I think, the 12th grade. The parents freak out. The students are quite happy with it. And it's basically hands-on. Students learn via hands-on activities. They do sculpture, plaster work, felt work, knitting, etc. All this craft work, as it were, really turns out extraordinary individuals. It's interesting that the Waldorf School in the peninsula, which is where Silicon Valley is, all the Silicon Valley techs send their kids there to the Waldorf School in the peninsula. And they have their nannies signed non-disclosure agreements that they will not use any technology in front of their charges, etc. And so what does this tell you? What is the hypocrisy? What do the tech moguls know that they're not telling us?
It's very interesting, insightful as well. You write about the importance of light, particularly sunlight.
Oh, yes. Light is an essential nutrient because it does fulfill all the requirements of a nutrient. It not only resets our circadian clock every day, but it synthesizes vitamin D in our skin, etc. But the most important thing is the way that it regulates our circadian rhythms and our sleep. Setting it each day to a 24-hour cycle.
Professor, what is the value of silence?
Oh, silence. Silence is golden. Isn't that a saying?
It is.
The brain needs silence. It was not meant to be stimulated 24/7 the way the endless scroll of the screen does. We need to have pauses. One of the best pauses is to just stop and take a breath in nature. I mean, nature is very restorative. Everybody knows this. If you only go to the beach or take a walk in the mountains or even in the woods near your home, silence is like a circuit breaker that stops this incessant babble and the incessant scrolling of screen, 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 screen.
Is that how we can safeguard our brains from the trappings of technology? Through nature and silence?
Well, that's one way. Yeah. I mean, as I say, nature is incredibly restorative. It's what the Dutch called niksen, or doing nothing. And so all you need to do is just stop and look out the window. Look at the clouds. Look at the trees. Look at the birds. Look at anything. It doesn't take much, 20, 30 seconds, and you have thrown that circuit breaker to make you stop being so engaged in this endless flow of visual screens.
You write about how social media shapes belief systems that can be out of touch with reality. And one example you use is the J6 riot at the Capitol.
Yeah, well, you know, social media is... First of all, social media is an oxymoron. There's nothing social about it, but it certainly can get people riled up. I think one of the things that it does is get people energized and riled up.
Well, Professor, we have 1 minute left. Overall,
yes.
What do you hope readers will take away from your book?
I hope they will see that it's possible to calm down and pause. I think that's the biggest thing, that it doesn't take much, but you just need to be able to allow yourself to pause from all these screens.
One quick follow-up. You write about loneliness, but there's a difference between people choosing to be alone and those who are lonely, right?
Well, just ask any teenager. Loneliness is a problem with these screens, but here's the thing. There's a difference between loneliness and solitude. Loneliness wants. Solitude has. And I think if you can appreciate the difference and see what a full, rewarding state solitude is, then you'll be better off.
Well, I thank you for that clarification. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Thank you, Professor, for writing such an insightful book.
Thank you so much for having me.
My guest was Dr. Richard Cytoic, professor of neurology at George Washington University and author of Your Stone Age Brain in the Screen Age, Coping with Digital Distraction and Sensory Overload. I'm Mike Green. You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange on JPR. And that's it for today's JX. JeffExchange.org is our website where you can find these conversations and more, or you can subscribe to our shows wherever you get your podcasts.